Welcome to Sidebar, our follow-up to Episode 12, Unit 2226. I'm Sean Gerd.
And I'm Scott Jameson.
Last episode, we went back to where it all started, Jennifer's condo. The last place she was known to be as she talked with her boyfriend on the night of January 23rd, 2006. We reviewed conversations with Jennifer's friends and family about her condo building. We also talked to her dad, Drew, as he mentioned some things that we'd never heard about before, like the knock on her door. And we also spoke to a woman who recounted an unnerving situation shortly after Jennifer's disappearance, at that same condo building. Today, we're going to respond to your questions and comments about all of that, and more. We're going to take a quick pause for our sponsor break, and then we'll jump right into it. This episode of Unconcluded is sponsored by Opinion Outpost. Market research is a $50 billion a year industry. Companies need input from people like you before they launch a new product or a service. And that's where Opinion Outpost comes in. Opinion Outpost is run by SSI, one of the most trusted names in consumer research. Opinion Outpost connects companies with people like you through online surveys that give you the chance to tell companies how you think and feel about virtually everything, from new products and advertising to social issues and more. And since they know your time is valuable, Opinion Outpost rewards you for taking surveys. You can earn cash, iTunes and Amazon gift cards, and more. Surveys are accessible 24/7, so you can participate whenever you like. Your personal information remains private and secure, and it's free to sign up. No credit card required. And you can earn actual money just by sharing your opinion. Sign up today at opinionoutpost.com/unconcluded to make your voice heard and start earning rewards. That's opinionoutpost.com/unconcluded. And we thank them for sponsoring this podcast.
Okay, we have a lot to cover in this episode, so we'll go ahead and jump right into the voicemails.
Hey, Sean and Scott. So after this latest episode, the biggest question that I have concerning the knock on the door, which Drew Kessie told us Jennifer was on the phone with Rob when she had a knock on the door, and that it was her upstairs neighbor, this guy. Well, my biggest question concerning that is, was this neighbor ever interviewed by police? And if so, my next biggest question is, what was his reason for why he went by her condo that night, knocking on her door? Throughout the years, I've always read that one of the neighbors that lived the closest to Jennifer was actually out of town when she was reported missing. I couldn't help but wonder if the neighbor that went by and knocked on her condo, is it possible that that's the same neighbor that ended up going out of town? If so, you know, them going by knocking, it could have been for something as innocent as to ask Jen if she could, you know, get their mail while they were out of town. If you were to find out that, you know what, we just can't confirm that this alleged neighbor was ever interviewed. We don't even know the neighbor's name. That would leave me open to the theory that perhaps the person that knocked on her door that night, maybe it wasn't a neighbor at all. You know, she's on the phone with Rob, her boyfriend that lives 2 hours away. We know from Rob that that night they did get into an argument on the phone. So maybe she's on the phone with Rob. The argument has blown over. You know, things are good now. And then out of nowhere, she gets a knock on the door. And Rob can hear it. You know, he's still on the phone with her. She looks out and maybe she sees that it's her ex-boyfriend. Would you really tell your boyfriend or girlfriend that's on the phone 2 hours away from you, getting ready to go to bed, like, hey, my ex just showed up at the door. I can see how so many people in that situation might fib. Be like, oh, it's the neighbor. That's just a thought that I had when it came out that there was a knock on her door. That's such a huge piece of information to me. And if we can verify whether or not this neighbor that supposedly knocked on her door was interviewed, that would really resolve some of the questions that I have concerning that.
The knock on the door is certainly one of the interesting pieces of information that came out of last episode. And up front, I'm not clear on exactly how Drew Kesey knows that the neighbor knocked on her door that night, or even what time it happened. I haven't had a chance to follow up with him on those questions yet. In fact, the first time I'm hearing this question right now, your voicemail, is as I'm recording this episode. So I think, though, you bring up a good point. If we make the assumption that her boyfriend was on the phone with her when the knock occurred, it's not outside the realm of possibility that if it was someone like you mentioned, maybe her ex-boyfriend or someone else, that she could have brushed it off with him as just a neighbor. Based on my conversations, I'm under the impression that this neighbor was talked to and there was an explanation. However, an impression certainly isn't fact, and I'm struggling to put into words exactly why I have that impression. So at this point, I think you make a good point, but we still need to follow up on it before I can really give a full answer that I feel comfortable with.
Hello, this is Dixie. I'm from Bowling Green, Kentucky, and I just recently found your podcast, and I really, really enjoy it. Well, I started back down to reading about the disappearance of Jennifer Kesey, and I got to the part about Deckard, and I was interested in that because my son lives in an area fairly close to there. And I just wanted to see what she was going to say. Well, I do believe the lady, definitely. There was just something about her with the details. However, one of the things that I wondered about, most jewelry stores have cameras. Now, possibly because they didn't think anything more about it, they did not check the camera until it was recorded over again. But I thought, wouldn't that be a good way to both identify the man who was with her and the girl to see if it actually did look like Jennifer Kesey? But I just thought I would bring that up, and I'm sure I'm not the only person that's thought about that. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
We've mentioned this previously. It's a hard question for us to answer. Not because we don't know the answer, but because we have to be careful how we explain it. So what I can say is this. There isn't a video to review. So any answers that would have been helpful from a surveillance video now or then aren't going to come. The good news is that the FBI did recently get involved, and hopefully they're going to be able to make sense of it or already have. So we'll have to trust that the professionals are getting to the bottom of the Deckard incident.
Hi, I've just been thinking, you know, as I listen to the podcast and everything that's happening, especially the one, the episode yesterday that talks about how the dogs trace her smell through the door, and they don't scent anything else. I was wondering if somebody checked all the apartments, thinking of the fact that so many apartments were empty and how easy it would be to hide a body when you have so many units and so many places that you can, like, basically hide a person. I'm not assuming that she's dead, but thinking that maybe somebody hasn't looked through that, and maybe the answers are right there, and they just haven't been looked through. Well, we know she might be hidden in the bottom of the building where she was living at. Just a thought. Thank you.
Well, the vacant condos and constructions certainly lend themselves to the ideas of being able to hide Jennifer right on site. It would have had to have been a temporary situation. To me, it's basically beyond the realm of possibility, based on what we've learned from construction and medical professionals, for Jennifer to still be at that condo building. I'll stop short of saying impossible, but everyone we've talked to has pretty much said just that. But what I do think is quite possible is the use of vacant units in the crime temporarily. Based on what we know, there is no evidence of that. But also what we know about some of the mistakes in the early investigation, I'm not willing to accept that no evidence ever existed, just because it wasn't found. And so, a temporary situation inside of a vacant apartment or somewhere else on the construction premises, I think is certainly something that we have to consider. We live in an on-demand world. Almost anything you want or need is available to you whenever you want. Just like Unconcluded, you listen when you want. Guess what? You can get postage on demand with Stamps.com. Which begs the question, why are you still going to the post office? Anything you can do at the post office, you can do from your own desk with Stamps.com. Buy and print US postage for any letter or package using your own computer and printer. And you can do it whenever you need it, 24/7. I take advantage of Stamps.com every week, mailing packages from my own desk without ever going to the post office. Right now, you can use our podcast title, Unconcluded, for this special offer. A 4-week trial, including postage and a digital scale. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else and click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Unconcluded. Again, that's Stamps.com. Enter Unconcluded. Stamps.com. Never go to the post office again.
Now we'll move on to our social media and email portion. First up, we have a social media post from Anne Marie, and she's new to the show, and she has a couple questions. She says, I do understand that the business sector in which Jennifer worked is one with issues, but is there a more specific reason why some people suspected that a colleague may be involved in her disappearance?
If you remember back to the Known Suspects episode, we read a complaint that was allegedly filed by a coworker of Jennifer's, which more or less implicated the colleague knowing something about Jennifer's disappearance. And that's basically where all of the suspicion around this individual comes from. It's been posted on various internet sites and shared on cable TV news shows for years. And to this point, none of the accusations have been substantiated that we're aware of. But they also haven't been debunked, which leaves us where we are with many, many people considering this person the main suspect.
Mary on Facebook brings up the point about Jennifer's briefcase and wants to know if it's true that Jennifer used to keep her briefcase in the car even at night and wouldn't bring it in with her. What would be the purpose in the abductor taking the briefcase with them and then either getting rid of it or keeping the briefcase?
Based on our conversations with some of Jennifer's friends, Jennifer leaving her briefcase in the car is possible. So if we're thinking about your question about why take it or keep it if you're the abductor, well, it's an important question. And I suppose there's several scenarios that could be possible. I think what's most likely is that the briefcase is wherever Jennifer is, which means she either had it with her when she was abducted, or it was in fact in her car that was used in her abduction. I tend to lean towards the latter. Whatever was in the trunk of Jennifer's black Chevy Malibu remains with the Orlando police to this day. And I think it's possible that the briefcase was in her trunk. So maybe it's in a locker at the Orlando Police Department. That's one option. And the fact that her briefcase isn't listed on the FBI VICAP alert about her disappearance is interesting. But it's also quite possible that she is abducted while carrying her briefcase. And that would make sense too, because her purse, iPod, and phones are missing as well. And that would just mean that it was likely taken because Jennifer was taken.
Cynthia says, can anyone remember when Jennifer was talking to Rob if it's been mentioned that she was in bed already?
We don't have a confirmed answer for this. However, I have seen mention on our Facebook group that an old CNN transcript included this information, that Jennifer was in bed when she was talking to her boyfriend Robert on the phone of January 23rd, 2006. But I haven't been able to find it myself. So if you're listening and you have that transcript or you know where I can find it, send it our way. But until then, I have to say right now that that answer is unknown.
Sean, as you can probably guess, we had a ton of comments about the quote-unquote realtors from Miami that were trying to get into our last witness's apartment. And Shannon sort of sums it up on Facebook. She says, quote-unquote, realtors from Miami roaming around at night with copies of condo keys to Orlando. Condos that are occupied isn't close to normal or okay. Makes you wonder what was going on behind the scenes and who was ultimately in charge.
Yeah, it definitely does not seem normal. I'd agree with that. And even if we could somehow buy into the idea that realtors would have keys or would be in town to show units, which I guess on its own doesn't seem completely crazy, but then it's in the middle of the night. I can't think of any situation where a realtor would need to be entering a unit in the middle of the night. And I think that's the reason that we wanted to share that audio with all of you in the first place, because it opens your eyes a little bit to things that aren't normal and gets us to think about them possibly playing a part in whatever happened to Jennifer.
John wants to know if there's any chance that the condo sales or management company kept a log of who was taking and returning keys.
Not that we're aware of, but that doesn't mean that there wasn't. And that said, if a log exists or did exist, I'm not sure it would be very valuable, and then I can't imagine it would be completely accurate. We've previously mentioned how the Kesseys have stated that the entry log for the front gate apparently wasn't kept up with very well, so I don't know why we would expect this to be any different if it even did exist, but we're not aware of it, and I can only imagine that 11 years later, even if it did, that our chances of finding it are probably close to none.
Jill says, please consider this. Mr. Kessie said Jen put a chair under her doorknob at night. I don't think she forgot to do it the night of the 23rd, but went out for something regarding work. She had her briefcase with her, in which case she had already packed her iPod, phones, and shoes for work the next day. Let's not forget Erica's account of seeing Jen in her office and then again outside the night of the 23rd.
You know, this comment brings up something that I'd thought about after the last episode, and that was the chair being used to jam the door, which, if we think about it, kind of rules out any keys being used to enter Jen's condo, well, at least while she was inside. So, if we assume that she put the chair in place as she always did, it would have to indicate that if the keys were used, they were either used for a lie-in-wait type of situation or after the fact. And I guess we can't make any conclusions, but it does make me think it's a little less likely that the copied keys were used to enter Jennifer's condo in order to actually abduct her.
Sunny says, I never thought the abduction was in the evening. I agree with Scott on his final answer, although you can't rule out the possibility. I've always thought that if Jennifer was abducted in the evening, it involved someone she knew because there's no signs of struggle. Why would she open the door, etc.? But I think this last episode changes all of that. It makes the worker theory very possible for an evening abduction.
Yeah, that kind of goes with the last question. Because with the keys, someone wouldn't have had to convince her to open the door. They could have just opened the door. But, as we said, if she had taken the safety precautions that she normally did, then even with the keys, they wouldn't have been able to open the door. And so again, she would have had to been convinced to open it. I think at this point, I still very much lean to Jennifer being abducted outside of her condo.
We received an interesting email from Lauren that we would like to share with you now. She says, I just started listening to the podcast and am riveted. I'm only through episode 7, so I apologize if I mentioned something that's been mentioned already. I still live in Orlando and lived in the Northbridge Apartments from January to June of 2005. The Northbridge Apartments at that time had a contract with the Disney College program to house the advanced interns, which are now called the professional interns. That's why I only lived there for 6 months. It was under construction at the time, and they were the first group of interns that lived there. I think that contract has now expired, but it did last a few years. Do you know if Jennifer had any ties to Disney interns that would place her at Northbridge a la The Witness from episode 5? Though the Northbridge complex was nice, the area was quite shady. The complex only allowed us 2 parking spots, even though we had 6 people living in 1 apartment. The other 4 cars were to park at the neighboring Nova Southeastern building. That was always too scary to walk to from at night, so I actually don't know anyone that did that. We took our chances with getting a ticket or getting towed. One night, I got into my car to go visit my boyfriend who lived near Universal. It wasn't very late, I do remember that. It had just gotten dark outside. I backed out of my spot, and as I did so, a man with baggy clothes stumbled, as if he were drunk or on drugs, towards my car from seemingly out of nowhere and tried to open my driver's side door. My doors were already locked, so I just gunned it before he could try anything else. I was too scared to come or go that night because it wasn't even that late. This is probably neither here nor there with anything having to do with Jennifer, but it's just scary to think that probably about 7 months before she disappeared, a sketchy person tried to open my door after I had just gotten inside it. I never reported it because I was a naive 22-year-old who didn't want to start any trouble and was about to move out of my apartment anyway because my internship was ending. I can't help but think, could it have been me? Could I have been abducted that night? I am 1 year younger than Jennifer, blonde hair and similar build, very scary. Likely he would have just robbed me. At least that's what I told myself. I was glad to move out of there shortly thereafter. Secondly, people seem to be baffled as to why the ex-boyfriend was the blue martini the night she was reported missing. Being around the same age as Jennifer, I can tell you that at that time, blue martini was the place to go for young professionals to get a drink after work. I don't think it is that odd that he was there. It was being so close to her apartment, I would think it's just a coincidence that he was there to get drinks. Lauren wraps up her email saying, I'm happy to see the signs for Jennifer, which have been faded and barely legible up and down Conroy Road, have been replaced by new signs. I hope and pray that this podcast brings forth new evidence and answers. Keep up the great work, everyone.
Yeah, I agree, Scott. I think that this is just another piece of information which doesn't tell us anything specifically about Jennifer, but does help us kind of keep our eyes open to not only the awful things that exist out there, but just how close they can be to home. I mean, just earlier today, you and I were talking about the serial killer that's on the loose not far from where I live. And as we kind of open our eyes to all that's around us, it's sometimes not a pretty picture. So I think it's important that we just kind of share these tidbits here and there, and people can kind of get the whole picture of what Orlando was like in 2006. Also, I did want to point out that she did mention the Blue Martini, and that was kind of a hot spot for people to hang out. And we agree. I think that makes sense. And to us, the boyfriend being, or the ex-boyfriend being across the street from her condo because he was at the Blue Martini just isn't as big of a red flag as it would seem initially.
Here's an email from Jules that I'm going to read pretty much in its entirety. And again, it's another long one, but it's a good email. And I believe it's another one that we need to get out there. Jules says, many thanks for doing this podcast. I first heard about Jennifer when I was on holiday in Orlando the year she went missing, and am worried about her ever since. I'm in the UK, so I feel frustrated that I cannot help more. I just wanted to put a scenario to you. It may be ridiculous, but it is something I have always thought may have happened. I wondered if it was possible that Jennifer, on the night of the 23rd, may have parked her car in a different parking space, i.e. located by the pond, where it would be closer to the stairs leading to her apartment. She had several bags, handbag, briefcase, and luggage. This is something I would do, especially if it was closer to the stairs. I am assuming this might be the case because of the complex being under renovation and not at full capacity. My scenario also assumes that she was abducted in the morning, she was taken in another vehicle, and her car was left behind. I then wonder, when Mr. and Mrs. Kessie rang the building manager to check on Jennifer, if he said the car wasn't there because he only looked in her assigned parking spot. As he checks her apartment, he then asks the workmen if they have seen Jennifer. This may spark chatter amongst everybody. If the person or persons responsible are amongst the workmen and they hear that people are looking for Jennifer, they may realize that they have to ditch her car because police and family members will soon be on the scene. And if the car is there, then obviously the focus will be on the apartment complex. This maybe answers why the tracking dog followed the scent to these stairs, and perhaps the person then got into a vehicle and drove away. The Huntington on the Green apartments being just far enough away so that it diverts the attention away from anything happening at the apartment. This also might explain what the car was doing from the proposed time of abduction to the leaving of the car at the HOTG. It may have been at the apartment all along until it was moved. It could then also explain the brazenness of the person of interest and that they already knew it was safe to drive the car as the police and Jennifer's family were still on the way. Thank you, Jules, for that email.
Yeah, this is something that you and I talked about before, Scott, especially when we talked about the bloodhound scent going back to those back stairs. Maybe it is possible that she did park on the backside of the building, even if temporarily, to make it easier to drag her luggage upstairs. I haven't talked to anyone who has said that this is something that she would do, but she also lived on her own and had only been living there for a couple months, so I do think it's possible, and it could explain some things. The scent, as I mentioned, the landscapers not seeing her car that morning if it was still there, and As the email mentioned, the condo management seeing that her car wasn't there because it was in its marked space, and then if the word gets out and suddenly the car seems to be moved right around the same time that Jennifer's parents had apparently called, it does seem like kind of a coincidence that that was the time that it got parked at the Huntington on the Green. So I think that that kind of theory is something that makes sense and something that we can think about as we continue moving forward. That's going to wrap it up for today. Thanks, as always, for joining us. And don't forget, if you think you may know something about the disappearance of Jennifer Kessie, the time to speak up is now. Call the Orlando Police Department and ask to speak to the detectives in charge of this case. Also, if you haven't had a chance to check us out on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, please do so. You can find them all at Unconcluded Pod. Music in this episode is by Lee Rosevere, and we'll see you next time.